Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. I'm Billy Allen.
I'm Nils Nielsen.
And I'm John Mayer.
This young man grew up in Van Nuys, California, the Valley. An all-star at Crespi High, he had the eye of every school in the country, but he took his talents to the Matadome, Cal State Northridge, the Harvard of the West Coast, where he set sauce all the way to the national championships in 93. In 1994, he went on The Price is Right with his CSUN sweatshirt tied tight around his jorts and a swagger that couldn't be contained. He left with a new car, and the world left with a glimpse of the future of television. The man with the moves of Michael Jackson and the voice of an angel on Red Bull. He graduated from Northridge with a BA in communications, and his commencement speech caused the 94 Northridge earthquake. He is the voice of the AVP, the heart and soul of Team Fletch, even though I see him on three different teams each six-man. He coached Sport Shack Volleyball to multiple national titles, where he inspired young women and crushed down balls. Wrist away, ladies! His knowledge of the game is inhuman. He can tell you the score of the Milwaukee Open Final from 1987 and the name of Todd Rogers' dogs. This man has performed on every stage, from the Lake Show to the Olympic Games. He even emceed his own wedding. He may be moving on to bigger and bigger things, but he's never left us or volleyball. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, Chris Geeter McGee!
Yes, wow. Billy.
Wow, Billy. Billy.
I mean, first of all, thank you, gentlemen. It is a pleasure to be on, and I have to say this. Just so the audience has a little background. Today, John had the great idea of maybe me doing it myself. And I said, you know what? No, let's have one of you guys do it. And by the way, this exceeded any expectation that I've had. I would have never come close to this. No one's ever given me an intro. And you know what? I was going to say, like, for me, people always go, hey, man, it was always my dream to have you intro me on center court. It always made me feel really, really good. It was always my dream to have you introduce me. So, Billy, thank you so much.
It was like trying to, like, paint a Picasso. It's just a crude replica.
I'll tell you what, the jean shorts with the sweatshirt tied around is pretty legendary because that's now 22 years ago, The Price is Right. And it's true. I was wearing jorts and literally like mid breakdance move, I had the time to tie my sweatshirt around my waist.
Well, we'll send a link in the show notes so people can get a glimpse of that Price is Right video because it's definitely worth watching.
Moving into much more serious banter now after that great intro and kind of on a similar topic, I just want to start out by asking, I know you've kind of lived your life in the spotlight and wonder how or if you still face nerves or because of all your experience, has it gotten easier?
No, I think it's a great question, Johnny. You know, for sure there are those moments and those nights where you're a little more nervous than others. Take Kobe's final game, for instance. And I don't know why that was more nerve-wracking, probably because the buildup for us was kind of like the Super Bowl, to be honest with you, for us, you know, with so much two-hour pregame show, hour and a half postgame show. But, you know, there you are at Staples Center instead of the comfortable confines of the studio, which I've been used to now for a few years. And you know, there's no prompter, there's no nothing. And you're just kind of going old school, you know, off the cuff. And it was more that nervous excitement energy that I haven't had in a while. And it was pretty cool because, you know, when you're in the studio every single night, yeah, to be honest with you, it almost becomes like riding a bike, you know, the nerves. Obviously there's certain games and that are a little more higher profile and moments like that. But I hadn't felt it in a long time like that. You know, there's times in my career that I can point to where, I'll tell you guys, when I did Beijing Olympics and that night I went on the Tonight Show and they had me do the introductions for Phil and Todd, I'm telling you guys, I had stuff in my stomach that I had not had in so long. And Todd Rogers actually laughing at me, like, dude, I've never seen you like this. It's kind of pacing. But you know what, man? It means you're alive. It's just like a big game, right? You guys are playing a huge match. It's the same kind of feeling. You have those jitters. You're playing it over in your head. But I always tell people, you know, as long as you're prepared and you're ready for that moment, you know, the nerves, the second for me that I start, boom, it's gone. You know when I get the most nervous? You guys will laugh at this. When I'm doing weddings. I swear to God, I don't know what it is, the honor of doing it and, you know, wanting to do a good job. I'm always really, really nervous before weddings. It's hilarious to think that.
So what does that preparation look like for you? Is it just getting all the information and the facts down?
Let's take the pregame show, for instance, for Kobe's final game, you know, a few days out, I'm already looking at the show rundown with the producer and thinking of certain things. And the day before, I'm writing a lot of my leads. So I have them. And you know what's really funny is, you know, I wasn't sure that day if I'd be able to. I'm like, listen, I know I have some on-camera leads. That's just going to be me. And they're really important ones that we'll probably submit for an Emmy. I knew that there was going to be a certain segment that was going to go on that reel, and it involved Lee Jenkins, who's a great writer for Sports Illustrated. He had an unbelievable essay on Kobe, and then it was going to be me leading into another feature. And, you know, you're used to having like a prompter, or maybe you can put your notes up, but it was just going to be me. And it was funny, like right before that moment, I was like, man, I had this whole thing written out, but it doesn't mean anything. I can't look off it. So you just got to go into the camera and proceed. And it was pretty cool. But I took a few days to write a ton of notes, go over the show with my producer a number of times, make sure I read everything at the studio before I went out to Staples Center. And you know what, to be honest with you guys, like when you're there, I got into a little bit of a zone, because a lot of times when I go to Staples Center, a lot of times we're remote somewhere, you know, you're high-fiving, you're looking for your friends, you're just kind of there enjoying the moment. It was interesting. About an hour and a half before the show, I was on that set. I never, ever left it until the game started, until our show, we were off the air. Like I was on that set for 3.5 hours. And I was just kind of looking through things and just getting dialed in, and I think it helped a lot. But it's funny, I was talking to my boss afterwards about 2 a.m, driving back from Staples Center. We're kind of going through the night, and he said, you know, if the Lakers won a championship, that's what our show would look like. Like we kind of did a championship show. Like it would be a 90-minute postgame, a 2-hour pregame. We'd be at Staples. We'd have Rick Fox and Shaq and all these special guests coming on. So it was like, I was like, it's so ironic. In their worst year ever in the history of the franchise, we had our greatest moment. We had a championship night. And I told him, I said, you know, he asked me how the whole, like right when the postgame started, guys, Rick Fox, Derek Fisher, and Gary Payton came over with Robert Horry and James Worthy. And there I was. And I just started doing like almost AVP style intros for him. I knew who had how many rings. Mm-hmm. And I told him after, I said, it just kind of happened organically. Rob called him over. And I said, man, I'll tell you, I've been preparing for this job for 44 years. Like literally, you know, I've been a Laker fan my whole life. In this moment, I had Shaq at halftime. We didn't know that was going to happen. We had Rick Fox and all these guys in the post, made Jeannie Buss in the pregame. You didn't know that was going to happen, but I was ready for it. You know, listen, it's 10-10 in Chicago, right? You're in the third game of a final, and all of a sudden the wind changes direction. You guys are ready, right? I mean, I was calm. I felt good. And I feel like when I feel prepared, I'm less nervous. You know, I'm obviously excited about it, and I know I want to be in the moment and I want to enjoy it, but there's that confidence feeling that I think I have. And I used to talk about that with coaching a lot I was coaching girls club, man. I'm sure you guys go through it as well. You know, when you go into a game and you know you're ready and you know your girls are prepared, the nerves more come in the play of like, man, it's a big game, or I just want them to play well. But when that game gets going and you're playing a chess match with the other coach, or you're making adjustments, that's the fun part. And you're so zoned in that you don't have time to really think about the nervous moment of it all. And I think that happened to me a little bit a couple nights ago.
I was kind of wondering if you had any kind of pre-rituals. It sounded like this one at the Staples Center was a little bit of an outlier, but is there something you do consistently, or like what did you do when you were talking about pacing in Beijing to prepare yourself or work yourself through those nerves?
No, man, it's a great question, because I think I always had different rituals for different events, I think, but I'm definitely a pacer, man. When I'm in that moment, like, you know, before, you guys have probably seen it, you know, AVP finals, I'm always kind of moving. I'm just real antsy, and it's hard for me to kind of sit still. And I had to learn when I went on set, I can't be sweaty and pacing back and forth, you know, so it's a different ritual. So it's funny you ask that, Nils, because I'll always like, I want to put my suit on about an hour and 15 minutes before I'm going on air. Okay. And then I always go in, I have the makeup lady brush. Yes, I wear a little bit of makeup. They brush it on. I like to be in that chair, and I like to be done an hour before, because then I come out, I highlight my rundown. All my bosses heckle me. They're like, why are you highlighting that? It's different colors. So I don't even use it in the show, but it's just me getting ready. And then I'll always like 20 minutes before the show, I'm gonna take a little walk, go fill up my hot tea, kind of do a little circle, heckle a few people on the way, walk around the building, and I'm back in my seat, gather my stuff, and I go on. And that's my pregame ritual, like I used to have as a player. When I was at Northridge, it was a My Hero sandwich, Billy. I mean, I always got the same one, right? So it's like, I've had to find, you know, the AVP, it was my pacing, or I'd had a, you know, certain thing before I would go down and have a little meeting with myself and fire up and then go. And so now that it changes, Nils. It's like, I still do it though. It's just like you're an athlete. I still prepare the same way, because I don't know any different. I really don't, you know, like same thing when I coached, you know, I have to have my rituals, because I think it puts you in a comfortable place. And the worst feeling going on TV or going into a big match or giving a speech is if you're not ready or something's thrown at you, you might feel out of sorts. And that's when you start to feel the sweat coming inside, right? And that's where the nerves start to come. So I've had to learn a lot about how to stay calm on the fly. It's like, say you're in a final for the first time and everyone's like, hey, act like you've been there before. Well, I haven't been to a final before on NBC. You know, you have to go to what's always worked. My calm place, I go to my little rituals, whatever it takes, you know, however you play, however you coach, you have to be in that kind of a mindset where you feel comfortable and you know, hey, I can deliver here. I've imagined this in my head, you know, and at the end of the day, you make a mistake, you got to let it go. And that's a big thing in TV too, guys, just like in sports. So say, you know, especially beach volleyball, I've always said, and you guys are out there, someone aces you and it's you, your partner knows it's you, the other team knows it's you, and all the crowd knows it's you. And all you're doing is wearing boardies, right? You're basically naked out there and you got me on the mic or someone going, hey, serve. And you're like, yeah, that's awesome. Thanks for telling everybody. You have to like go, hey, water off a duck's back, relax, boom, they're serving me again. Same thing. Like I've made so many mistakes on TV and I always think they're so bad. And you know what? Ultimately, they're never that bad. They're always way worse to you. But when you make a mistake or you flub a name or you say something stupid, I've learned to kind of make a little joke and move on, or I just let it go and never mention it again. So, you know, pressure can come in so many different forms. And one thing about pressure, gentlemen, is it can come at any time. You know, pressure can change. I could go into a show feeling great and then all of a sudden something might change and the pressure can happen midway through. And I think people got to realize that while they're coaching and when they're playing, like pressure doesn't just necessarily mean to start things. It's always amplified when you start a match, when you start a game, or when I start a show, but it can change and pressure can come in at the end. It can come in any time. So
say you have a young player, or maybe some mm-hmm. players you coached in yeah. club. Yeah. And they are not good at handling pressure.
Yeah.
Where do you start with those players?
Man, that's tough. You know, I think what we used to always do, you know, Billy and I coached together at Sport Shack and fortunate enough to have some great teams. And I coached some great boys teams too, back in the late 90s. And that's kind of where I started. You know, I was really young then too, man, like, you know, mid 20s. And I think I evolved as I went on, but I feel like when it came to pressure, those kind of moments, I think I used to be a big speech guy, but then I realized that was more just for fun and it got guys fired up. At the end of the day, I've realized over time, you need to help train these women, these men, and put them in pressure situations in practice and talk about it. And don't be afraid to open up and express feelings and tell them it's okay to not, you know, play your best certain times. And it's okay to fail, man. I mean, you know, I hate to always go back to the Lakers, but it's pretty ironic that, you know, Kobe Bryant first real failure was his rookie year when he shot 4 air balls in the Western Conference semifinals when he was a rookie. And now he ends his career against Utah and he scores 60 and they win the game. It was kind of a cool, you know, full circle moment. And it's interesting. His first points ever as a pro were from the free throw line. His last from the free throw line. I thought that was kind of fitting because where else are you alone in basketball than on the free throw line with pressure, with everyone watching, with quiet arena, you're shooting, you know? So I always talk to players about in those big moments, not pretending they're not big. Embrace the pressure. Embrace that moment. Realize where you are and give it a big ass hug, I used to say. I mean, there's this elephant in the room, right? When you're in the Olympics or when you're in a big match and it's right there and it's like, you can't win, this team is too good, or you choked last time, or we've never been here. Whatever that pressure is, or whether you're the Golden State Warriors, you're like, everybody's gunning for you. It doesn't matter because you got to look that moment in the eye and say, let's do this. Momentum's going to go from side to side. We're going to battle. We're going to fight. But I know when I'm in here, I'm going to give everything I have. I've been here before. I've worked in my head when I was 5 years old, trained it for practice. Enjoy it. Don't run from it. I think what happens to people is they get into gnarly moments and they think they have to be someone else. I always told teams, and Billy, you know, you were around for those teams. The last couple titles we won in 2010, 2011, we were real lucky to go back to back. I mean, so many things had to go our way. But I'll never forget telling the girls, you don't have to play special to win this match. You don't have to play your best. You don't have to be not you. You just have to play together, play well, make adjustments during the games. And I've always said this too about pressure, guys. Do not be afraid to take risks. People who take risks are not afraid of the moment. If you play safe and you try to play, look at Jordan Spieth. I mean, how good is Jordan Spieth, you guys? I mean, Jordan Spieth is, without a doubt, he's the next closest thing to Tiger that we've ever seen. I mean, this guy is so money. He putts so well. He's got ice in his veins, as they say. And here he is with a 5-shot lead on the back nine at Augusta, a place where he dominates. He said it after, which I give him a lot of credit for. He said, I thought in my head, and this is a guy who's won 2 majors. He thought in his head, pars get me home. I'm going to play it safe. And he went bogey, bogey. And then he gets to 12. And now that 5-shot lead's at 3. He makes the mistake of seeing that. And then he mishits it. He goes for the flag, which you're not supposed to do on 12. You go for the middle of the green because of the way that is. It's a par 3. And he goes in the water. And here's the thing where, like, he's not thinking. And this is where, you know, your coach or your caddy, this is where they should have taken their time. He goes and drops from 60 yards. Well, for those people who play golf, 60 to 70 yards is the one place you don't want to be. You either want to be chipping from close or you want to be longer. It's kind of in between irons, right? So he goes from 60, 65 yards and chilly. He looks like me at the par 3 ratty over here at Manhattan Beach. He flubs it into the water and you're like, all of a sudden you're like, wow, he choked. I mean, he literally, guys, just didn't think in that moment. He got rattled. He got outside of himself. And listen, that's going to happen. That's going to happen whether you're a champion or whether you're not. I mean, Magic Johnson was 19, 20 years old when he went for 42, 16 and 10 or whatever, or 7 in his rookie year in game 6 of the NBA Finals. Well, listen, the next year he also threw the ball away to lose. So it's going to happen. You're going to fail. But you can't be scared of it because you're going to get more opportunities in it. So, you know, I'm always telling players to embrace those moments, Nils. I'm always telling them to don't be afraid to look around and see what you're in and have a moment to reflect on it and say, hey, man, I'm here and I deserve to be here and let's get after it and have some fun.
Were there any specific drills that you did that put players in pressure situations that were?
Yeah, we did with 5-3 side out drill. I don't know if you remember that one, Billy. I think you might have played with us a couple times or watched, but we used to do where you got to get 5 side outs before this the other team gets 3 real points. And at girls club volleyball, man, it's a lot harder than you'd imagine. You know what I mean? It's not like you just set the D every time and you got a guy that just pikes 5 balls in a row and you walk out. You know, there's no full dollhouse on the other side. So we used to go and you have to go through all 6 rotations. And it was pressure because they would, if they lost, you know, there's always, you know, running on the line. There's all kinds of stuff on the line, right? So you don't want to lose. You have people down your back, you know, yelling at you. And it's funny because rotation one time took our team in 2011. It took probably 50 minutes and we could not get it. And the girls were like starting to fight. We took them, we sent them home actually. And we came back and we said, we're going to do this drill and we're going to do this rotation until you win it. And we said, because one day you might be signing out for a national championship in this rotation. Now, by the way, we just said that, but you fast forward a month later, we're in Atlanta and we're in the national championship game. We get boat raced in the first, probably 25-12, 25-13. We did not get one real point. The team sided out every single time. We go to the second game. We're down 9-2. And our girl, big game, Jane Croson, went back and got about 9. We call timeout. And I remember Tim telling them, like, this game's passing you by. You guys are out there playing not to lose and you're getting crushed and it's going to be over with in 15 more minutes. And you're going to say, you're going to regret it forever. And you're always going to flash back to this game. We go back out of the timeout. Jane hits 9 jumpies. We take like an 11-9 lead, 11-10 lead. And we rolled from there. We went to the third and I'll never forget it. We got up 14-10. They scored 11. They scored 12. We called timeout. We said, look at the score. We said 14-12. We said, what rotation are we in? We're in rotation one. How many times did we work on rotation one? Because when they came back that next practice, they got out of rotation one. They went home. We sent them home. We came back. We met. We talked about it. They came out and they got rotation one like that. And we went on and they ended up winning the drill action. And I remember saying, all you got to do is side out one time in rotation one, not 5, just once. Went out, sided out, won the title. It was pretty cool. But it was a pretty cool coaching moment that, like, it was something, Nils, that we trained. And we trained all the time and we put a lot of pressure on. Billy can tell you, we weren't easy on those 4 girls. I mean, we trained hard and we put them in moments and we made them feel it. And then when they didn't compete at the highest level or they didn't deliver, we'll let them know. And I just think, you know, that 5-3 drill for us was something that, you know, for those couple of years we went back to back, we all the time, when we were up, we'd be like, 5-3, 5-3, side out. You know, that's all we talked about. It's pretty cool.
So you've been around through volleyball and basketball, so many just amazing players. What separates a guy that's a great athlete, volleyball player, from a guy that wins? And is there such a thing as clutch?
It's a great question too, Billy. God, you guys are good. You know, I'll tell you this. The difference between a great player, and for me, when you say great, I'm thinking kind of superstar level, right? Someone who's probably a Hall of Famer or close to it. They do it on a consistent basis, and they do it no matter what the elements or where you are, and they do it more times than not. So say you're playing 7 games in a week, they're giving you 5 or they're a star. They're giving you that, they're a Hall of Famer. I mean, the difference between the great ones is, guys, they can go over to China, they can go to Brazil, and then they could fly back to Charleston, South Carolina, and they can get their mind right because their body is so tired, and they can get into a place where they know that they're just going to side out, they're going to play their game, they're not going to get up and down too much. I think the players that are great sometimes, guys, watch them. They're like a roller coaster, right? I mean, you see it in the NBA, you see it in any sport. When they're riding high, they're unbeatable. But then when they're down here, you stomp them. The teams that are really good are always here. I mean, I'm telling you guys, I'll never forget the look on Kerry and Missy's face in Beijing. I'll never forget it. There I am, emceeing the Olympics, and I woke up. You talk about nerves. I mean, I was so nervous that morning. Back then, I was announcing almost every tournament. I was announcing all the AVPs for sure and some internationals. They had not lost for over a calendar year. They had not lost a match. The last time they had lost was early July 2007. They lost in a semifinal in a monsoon against China. So now you get to the finals 13 months later. They're in China against China. And I open the blinds at 7 in the morning, and it's a monsoon. You can't even see. And I thought to myself, oh my God, this is going to be gnarly. It's going to be 20,000 people in that stadium. It's pouring rain. It's that Chinese team. I was like, they're so gnarly. I'm like, oh my God, I wanted it so bad for those girls. And of course for me, because I wanted to announce the United States win a gold. So I remember going, and it's just raining. I'll never forget going kind of down. And where I was under this, like, you know, umbrella type things, and I'm announcing, and they're right there. I can see them. And I remember just water dripping off the visors and the hats and their cheeks. And I'll never forget the look in their eye. And they were so steady in that match. I felt like their concentration was just at another level. And they thought, these are not our elements. This is not our game. We don't play our best in this. And guys, they were a machine. They sided out the whole time. Nonstop. China could not score. And China started acting, you know, John Wall, her name was, she would fall on the floor and pretend she was hurt and take the 6-minute timeout, and the medical would come. And I'm like, oh my God, she's trying everything in the book. Like, do you guys remember playing the Bruins? They would, Eric Sullivan would go and wipe the floor, and you're like, dude, there's no spot on the floor. I hate you, UCLA. Why do you have to cheat all the time? Stein, and they're wiping the floor, and you know, yeah, Caitlin knows, go ask her. No. So, I used to drive me insane. Well, China was doing that. They were doing that the whole time. And Kerry Misty never pulled any of that crap because they don't need it. So that's the difference to me between the greats that win, is they're just doing it all the time. And they train that hard. They keep their mind right. They keep their body right. And when they're in those moments, guys, they know that they don't have to be someone else. And I think like clutch is such a great topic. I mean, I would love to hear your guys' take. I mean, you know, listen, Kobe was always known as clutch. LeBron is now clutch. I mean, they say Kevin Durant is clutch, and he just went 1-for-10 and missed basically a layup to win the game, and went 1-for-10 for 3 at a wide open 3. So like, clutch is, you know, your ability to perform at your best on the brightest stage in that moment. And no one's 100% clutch. I mean, there are guys that can do it more times than not. And I think that's what gets you the clutch gene. But guys, there are just people also that they're just in the right place at the right time, and they're able to seize the moment. Robert Horry is one of the most clutch guys of all time in the history of the NBA. And I've asked him about it. He just always felt like he could hit the shot, and he always found himself in the right spot. And people were always like, you know, when Vlade tipped in that ball in the famous 2002 shot that he hits at Staples Center to beat the Kings at 3, where Staples Center goes nuts. I've had the best conversations just like we're having with him. And I'm like, what the hell were you doing out there? Why were you at the 3-point line when everyone else is trying to tip it in for the win? He goes, you know, when you're a kid, you're always taught, you know, if you're a big guy and another, you know, tap the ball out towards half court when the clock's winding down, because like, you know, that's where nobody is and the game will end and who's going to run it. And he goes, so I just figured, like, you know, Robin is like, well, he's like, man, I just figured, like, I mean, Shaq's in there, Kobe's in there, I'm not getting the ball. So I just figured if someone's going to tip it out, they're going to tip it out right here. And there he was standing 25 feet away, right where the ball comes. I mean, that's, I don't know if that's a definition of clutch, but man, that's pretty damn cool. pretty damn cool. And, you know, he's just in those moments, man, he always had that ability. I mean, there's a guy, I mean, look at another sport, a guy named Mike McGee, who played for the LA Galaxy. He wasn't Landon Donovan. He's not Robbie Keane. He's not a big time goal scorer, but when they got in big moments in playoffs, he always had a goal. He always was there in the right spot. And I just think there's guys that are built for those moments that aren't afraid and they want to be there. They want to take that shot. They want to be in front of Manhattan open crowd with 15,000 and they want to whip a jumpy. You know, I'll never forget, guys, this is my first JOs I ever won. It was 1997. I'm coaching 16-year-old boys volleyball. And I used to let a kid, his name was Charlie Woods. We called him Icky because the old running back, Icky Woods, who played for the Bengals. And we would let him jump. So we had a little jumper, but he would miss it a lot. And I'll never forget a couple of the dads would always sit, you know, the parents sit, you know, on the back line, and they're always just like totally talking about you. And you're like, yeah, dude, I can see you. I know way more about volleyball than you do. So please, you never played it. You don't have any idea what you're talking about. They would get so pissed when I would sub Icky in and he would miss a jump serve, and he missed a lot. But I always wanted him to go in and do it. And I wanted him to be in moments and clutch moments. I didn't care if he missed in February. I didn't. And we had an unreal team, Billy Strickland, Kurt Topple. I mean, this team was lights out. And we won all the time. But I knew, like, we might need this kid at some point, and we might need him to come up big. And I want to know if he can. So he missed all the time. I'll never forget this one dad used to always tell me, like, I have no idea, Geeter, why you do that. And I'm like, I don't need you to know. I have confidence in the kid. Sure enough, big semifinal against Balboa Bay. Who came in at 12-12 and got two spaders? Icky Woods. I'll never forget it. That was probably his only two spaders of the year. But, like, you know, that's what I did. I was only 24 at this time. But I knew that, like, I brought him in. I was one of those guys who had to come in. Like, Price would put me in to come deep, sir. And it could be 13-13 or whatever. And, like, you just – I knew, I believed in that kid that he could do it. And I think that's also part of being clutch. Like, knowing, you know, I think you guys all understand this. And whoever, you know, whomever listening – when you're at your best, when you're at your very best, think about it with your wife, with your kids, with your sports, with your job, how confident you are. How do you feel personally when you're at your best? When you're dropping 20 in a hoops game, when you're dialing up aces, Johnny, you're scooping. You know, I'm watching you scoop the other day against Gibb. You guys are playing so good at the end of that match against Casey and Spiker. Give that, you know, you're in a little bit of zone, right? I mean, you're scooping balls, you're delivering. That one set was real wide. You hit it cross court and Jake's looking and it drops. And it's like, dude, you've done that a million times. How do you feel at that moment? You feel really damn good. You feel really good. You know what? Someone else believes in you. Like, when people believe in you, whether it's your coaches, that's why positive coaching is such a big thing. Like, you always got to pat them on the back too. You know, you want to be hard on them, but you got to let them know when they're great. And you got to pat them on the back and you got to build them up, because if you believe in them, they're going to achieve a lot more for you. I mean, I really believe that. Same with your kid, the same when you're in a job. So for me, it's like, I know when I'm at my best, I feel pretty damn good. I feel pretty damn good. And someone believes in me and you feel like people believe in you. That's also part about being clutch.
You're in February at the Goldmine Gym. Icky misses his jump serve. What are you saying to him as he's walking back to the bench? Is it just that you are keep putting him in, or are you also giving him feedback?
Yeah, giving him feedback. You know, obviously that's a great question too, Billy. Like, I don't, you know, there's those moments, guys, and I think you'll all understand this, where, like, you don't want to overcoach, right? So, but he's 16 also. So if there was an issue with toss or something, then I would absolutely say something. But a lot of times I would say, nice job, Ick. No worries, man. You'll get another one. No, or hey, don't be afraid to crack it. You know, a lot of times I'd tell him, I'd just go, crack it. You know, I'd always be like, give him a little slap when he's walking by me, and I'd like, go crack it like that. He's gonna smile, and you know, I want him to feel good and loose. But I would tell him, hey, don't be afraid, go out there and whack it. And sometimes I'd be like, great serve, man. Hey, just missed. You know, stuff like that. And other times I'd be like, hey, you know, there's other times where I would feel it out. And I knew who he was. After a year, I could, you know, I could work with him, and I could be like, sometimes I'd be like, Dick, I need you to hit that. When I put you in, I got to have you hit that. Like, you can't be afraid to coach people like that, but you have to know your personnel. There are certain players you can absolutely get into, and some you can't. But hey, I'll never forget this too. And Billy, you were a part of the club then. You know, we had a great player named Jane Croson, who was probably one of the best we ever had. And I'll never forget early on in her career with us. She played 2 years. This was in her first year. She was kind of loafing. And Tim and I looked at each other and we go, let's find out what kind of kid we got here. And we didn't say a word to her. And we put her on the second team and never talked to her for an entire, like, hour. And she never came back onto the first side. And this was a kid that you wouldn't even dream of ever putting on the B side. And we didn't even say anything to her. We just kept coaching her moments. We were as happy as could be. We didn't yell at her. We didn't say, "You're loafing." We just sent her over there. And all of a sudden she starts waking up to it. And she starts realizing it. And she just bombs. And she just starts delivering. And the B side is crushing the A. And she's playing the best. She played, never said a word to her. Not a word. Not great job. I mean, little things like, "Hey, bunch here." Like when there are little mistakes, we just coached her like it was totally normal. But we never pumped her up. We didn't rip her down. Just like, "Hey, good job here." No, whatever. Never a word after practice. Next practice. Took her aside. And we said, we asked her. We put it on her. I didn't tell her. We said, "What did you learn from last practice? I thought you did a good job," like that kind of, you know, and she goes, "Well, I wasn't trying for half a practice and I just wasn't into it mentally." And we go, yeah, we thought that too. "What woke you up?" "I didn't like being on the B side." And we said, "Okay, now you know how we roll. We will put you," and we told her, "We will put you over there. We'll take you out of a game." I said, "Look at this team, plenty of kids ready to go. You know what? We knew we had a kid that would be able to take that kind of feedback and would be able to react." And I think that's really important for all young coaches out there. You got to get to know your kids, and you can't be afraid to push them a certain way. But you always, you know what, guys, like if you over push or you know, listen, we're all going to make mistakes, man. I made plenty of them. You know, you yell at a kid the wrong way, you know, even say, you know, cuss, whatever it is, like certain kids, man, that's not cool. And you have to respect that that's not cool with them. And you need to sometimes own it. Be like, "Hey, I made a mistake. Here's my mistakes." You know, sometimes after matches, "Hey guys, this one's on me. I didn't prepare you enough. I think it put you in the wrong spots. I'm going to do better next time. What are you guys going to do?" And then they'll tell you. So, you know, I think the give and take that way builds trust with the team, you know, and I think that's the best way to get out of your kids, man. You know, can't be afraid to push them. Can't be afraid to light them up, but you got to show them love too. Got to show them love.
That's awesome. Cause I picture you and Tim as two of the most confident people I know. But for you guys to be vulnerable in front of the team, that's
– yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, listen, Billy, for sure, man. I mean, you know, we're definitely cocky and had fun with that. But, no, at the end of the day, had to be honest. And I think kids also see through that. And, you know, there was an air of confidence that you have when you know, that comes with, I think, guys like, you know, by the time we got later in our careers, people would come play expecting a certain thing like, "Oh, you just put on the shorts and we're going to go out and we should be national contenders." And that our message was always, that's not how it works. And the challenge we always had, it wasn't a problem, but sprinkling in new kids every single year, it's tough because, you know, you're dealing with different personalities and they don't know each other and it takes time to mesh. And the problem I think with youth sports nowadays is, and it actually just goes all the way to the pros, people have this like win now mentality. And I don't know if you guys ever talked about this on other shows, but it drives me insane. Like everybody is so afraid of the process and the journey. And for me, any championship team I've ever been a part of, I'm talking rec league basketball to club volleyball to hoops to whatever, my Pop Warner football team, there is a process and a journey that goes. It's very, very rare that you come out on day one and you're the best team. And by the end, you're the best team. Yes, there are moments like that. There are teams like that where you're real fortunate. But if you're a new team coming together, you have to mesh. You have to try different things. You have to use your bench. You have to be in certain situations. You have to lose. You have to lose so you learn how to deal with it and how to get better. I mean, every JOs we ever had, we lost. You know, that last one we won in Atlanta, we were 1-2 in pool play after day one. Kids fighting, we were done. People fought. We had to go 7-0 the rest of the way to win it. And we did. But it, you know, it's like, you know, parents, I remember in the Vegas tournament, guys, back in the day with club, and I don't know if girls club still does it because I've been out of it for a few years, but the 18s always had the Vegas tournament in February. Well, JO's wasn't until June. Well, you know, in all of our years, Tim and I only won that one time. 2001 was the only time we won Vegas. We lost in the finals. We got in third. We got in some fifths. There were times we didn't do well. Those championship years, 2010, we took 17. People wanted to quit because they didn't like the lineups we were playing and we didn't win and they were in a panic. And Tim and I had to have a meeting with parents and said, "You have to trust this. These are new kids coming together. We're going to try different things. You need to have, you brought your kid here to be coached and be trained. Let us do it. We're a month and a half into the season and you're freaking out." And that's the biggest problem that club coaches face today is parents want it now. Everyone wants to win Everyone wants to start. Everyone's got to be the man. And to me, it's just, it's ridiculous. It's really hard to teach a team concept at a high club level.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with the second part of our conversation with Geeter. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes to get the latest episodes right when they come out. And while you're on iTunes anyway, we'd appreciate you writing a review. Hi, welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. This is part two of our conversation with Chris Geeter McGee.
Every great team I've ever had, there's always been one set of parents or a couple that weren't that happy. Now, the funny thing is their kid was happy. Their kid enjoyed being on the team, but the parents were not. It was never easy. I never had a perfect season all the way through where everywhere it was all kittens and candles the whole time. Never. And you know what? I don't want it that way. I want to have battles. I want to have fights. I want to get through tough times. I want to get my ass kicked. I want to come out on the other side, and I want to come out better for it. And I think that's a big problem because they don't allow it to happen. You know, now you get fired if you lose after a year.
From our message board, Coach Jackson, he asks, what do you do if a parent is not buying in?
Ooh, that's a tough one, man. I've faced it many times, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you and say that it always worked out because it didn't. You know, I can go all the way back to my first ever basketball team at Campbell Hall Middle School, High School. Tim Jensen got me my first job. I was actually still taking some classes at the Ridge. My eligibility was up. It was 94, 95. And I was the head coach of the seventh grade boys basketball team. And they had come off a championship in sixth grade. Well, I don't know if you guys know this, but when you go from sixth to seventh, it's a little bit different. All of a sudden you're playing some different teams in your junior high. Kids are a little bit bigger. And we had to battle. And these kids were like stars in sixth grade. Well, they came to seventh. And, you know, I'm 23, 24 years old, and I'm trying to run a system in seventh grade hoops and trying to teach himself. And I had a dad that pulled me aside and he was like, hey, I coach these kids in summer league. Why don't you come hang out with me for Saturday? You know, I'm going to teach you our offense. And I kind of fell into this trap, right? And this guy wanted to be my best friend. And he was showing me plays and took me to UCLA hoops games. And his son was the point guard. And he was like, do it this way. And I started thinking to myself, that's kind of not how I want to do it, but I'll kind of sprinkle some of his stuff and I'll do mine as well. And I'll never forget, we got to a game and we were playing Harvard Westlake, and it was a small, tiny gym and it was packed. And it was the most intense situation that I still remember to this day, guys. My dad was at the game. I remember that. My dad came to the game and watched, and I'll never forget. We still talk about it today, but I'll never forget the high intensity of it and these parents going nuts, dude. It was like gymnast at the Olympic parents on steroids, dude. It was like unbelievable. It's like little league soccer parent all rolled into one and in a little box of a gym. And my point guard is throwing up air balls and he got a technical foul and he's getting rattled, right? And we're down like eight with a couple minutes and he gets a technical foul and I take him out. And I take him out, sit him down. He hasn't been out all year and he's like ready to cry and his dad's freaking out. And I sit him down and I said, I need you to calm down. My point guard, you got to run this team. And if your shot's not falling, you have to impact the game other ways. I said, you're not doing that, John. I go, sit down here, calm down. I'm going to get you back in. I put in a little kid, this little kid's backup point guard. He plays out of his mind. We come back, tie the game, go into overtime. I actually end up putting my point guard back in overtime. We end up winning that game. And his son ended up playing great when he came back in. We won that game. And for me, it was like this really unbelievable moment with all this pressure. And, you know, I'm coaching by myself and making calls and subbing guys in and out. It's really hard, you know, and I'll never forget the dad pulled me aside outside, never forget, by my car. And he lit me up. He lit me up like in my face. And I remember thinking to myself, there was a part of me that's like, dude, I want to kill this guy. And another part of me that was in shock. And then there was another part of me that was like, you know what? You did the right thing. And I hadn't coached my whole life. I had literally been coaching club. Even when I was in college, I was always assisting club team. So I had been around it. I had been coaching since I was 18. This was like my first time on my own. But I'd been an assistant. Like I felt good about what I did. I was a point guard. Like I finally let him go. He talked about how he stunted his kid's growth. By the way, his kid was so small, he was never growing anyways. He stunted his growth. I killed his confidence. He was never going to be the same. How dare I? He took me to UCLA games. And all I said was, Mr. Carabas, and I hope he's listening. I said, Mr. Carabas, haven't talked to the guy in 25 years. Mr. Carabas, I said, I believe what I did was the right thing. I said, by the way, we won the game, but even if we had lost the game, I said, I really feel in my heart, we did the right thing. And I'll tell you why. I took John out and he responded. Like, he understood the moment. Like, he understood that he got a technical. I had to take him out. I mean, he was losing it and we were down and he never talked to me again the rest of the time. You have probably 6-7 more games. Never talked to me again. So Jackson, sometimes they don't buy it. And now fast forward, 17 years after that, there I am, with the best team in the country trying to win a girls JO championships. And I have my third outside hitter quit. She quit in the middle of the season. And I went and we had to go, me and my buddy, Tim, who I coached with, we had to drive out to Flint Ridge past Pasadena and meet with them at a Starbucks. And we had to we didn't suck on any crow, but we basically had to say, listen, here's how we coach. We need her. We need her because if we want to win this thing with our team, we need her to play. We need her to be there. You can't just roll with two outside hitters. Here's why she's not starting. We'll try to do a better job of getting her in there, but she's a part of this team. The girls like her. She ended up coming back and playing, and we used her in one match that was pretty critical, JOs, but she didn't play much besides that. And, she wasn't happy. Her parents weren't happy. But, to answer your question, like, if they don't buy in, you have to just tell them the truth. You got to tell them the truth, and you got to tell them what you believe in. And you have to say, if you really need them, this is why I need you. This is why I want you. But if it's not for you, then don't do it. Because if it's not for them and they end up, listen, I've had nightmare parent situations. I've had people that I thought were friends never talk to me again. Because as soon as they're done with you, they're on to the next thing. They're on to the next coach. They're on to their next job. And you're not benefiting their daughter or their son anymore. So they don't need you. A lot of these guys are CEOs of companies and stuff. They boom, 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 they're on to the next one. And you know what? If they're not going to buy in, as much as it might hurt your team, it's better in the long run. I finally got to a point in my career where I was like, dude, I want to roll with who's ready to go. Yeah, does it hurt us? Oh, well, then it hurts us. And if they can't understand that you're not just hurting me and your daughter, you're hurting the whole team. I think that a lot of times gets people too. I think if you have that situation with a parent, I think you have to, whatever your team belief is and your team concept and your motto and your beliefs, you got to sell it, man. You got to sell it like you're on the car lot, man. You sell it. Sell yourself. Sell your vision. Sell why the team is important. Sell why you need her or him to stay. Sell why you coach this certain way. This is my system. Here's why. And you know what? They don't want on board. They don't want on board. They can go other places. That's the beauty of it. But be upfront with them, man. Be upfront with them from the get-go. Tell them what they're getting into. Don't promise anything. Real quick before you guys go on to the next question, Jane, who I talked about earlier, she was leaving her club, Cal Juniors, and everyone knew. It was like LeBron was going to be a free agent. Everyone knew Jane was leaving Cal Juniors. She went and tried out at Long Beach. She went and tried out at Laguna. She went and tried out at Shaq all the same days. And us at SportCheck, I'll never forget this, like it was yesterday. Her mom, who I love, Lila, came in after tryouts. We really loved it. It was great. Pulled me and Tim into the side room at Marymount where Billy had to shag balls all the time. Side room and said, do you plan on having, she had this little, Polynesian Hawaiian style. She said, do you plan on having Jane, start and go all the way around? We'll start. And by the way, of course she's going to start. She's best player in the country. And I'll never forget before I could even answer, because Tim and I have always said, we coached 19 years together. We said, we promise that to nobody. We got to stick by that. I'll never forget Tim, as cocky and as confident as can be. Lila, I can't do that. We don't promise, starting positions, because I've never coached Jane. So I have no idea. We have a really good team. I'll tell you this. I think she's going to be a big part of what we do. And she goes, okay, thanks. And she left. She walked out the door. Tim looked at me and he goes, did I just lose us Jane Christen? And I go, yeah, you might have. We kind of laughed about it. Got a call late that night that she was in. But we were up front with her. I mean, I felt like the minute she asked, I felt like going, yes, she'll never come out for 2 years. But we didn't do it. We were honest. So it's kind of cool.
Love the honesty. To kind of go back to, you touched on Kobe and his retirement, and just want to make sure we hit on a little bit more and maybe just some personal things you've seen firsthand that's made Kobe Kobe. I know we've heard a lot about him, but
he's coming on next week too.
Yeah.
it's funny, Johnny. Kobe can be the most charming guy of all time. He walks into a room. He just commands this respect and this presence. And it could be in the gym at El Segundo where their practice facility is. It can be at Staples, or it can be at the Olympics where I met him in Beijing. And I'll never forget, like, not knowing anything about Kobe personally, just being a fan and covering the team for a couple years, but never even, I've never covered 06, 07. I never covered the home team. So I would see him and never talk to him. I met him at the Olympics in Beijing. He came to like three volleyball matches to watch Carrie and those guys. And I would always weasel down into where I knew they would be. And I would always take that match off so I could hang with him. And Sinjin would let me in, and I would go in there and I would start touching base with him. We started rapping out, and he started asking me questions about volleyball. So we formed a little bit of a relationship. So then when I started covering the actual Lakers sideline later that year, he knew who I was. And he's so charming when he wants to be. He's so competitive. And the thing about him, guys, and you can tell by watching that last game and watching him throughout this year, is he's always ready for whatever he's doing. He wants to be so engaged with that. He wants to know, what makes you so great? Why is Roger Federer, why is Jokic so great? Why is Messi the best at what he does? Why is Spielberg so good here? Why is this guy the best storyteller? Because now he wants to tell stories as a production company and all this stuff. I mean, he dives into whatever he's doing. It's maniacal. And, you know, to be the best, you have to make a ton of sacrifices. But there's legendary stories. You know, Luke Walton would tell me that Kobe would, you know, 6 a.m. Luke always said, Kobe never sleeps, dude. He's going to bed at 2 because he's thinking too much. He's up at 4:35. He's in the gym. He's already had a full day before the Lakers would get there at 10. And I always said that puts them on a different level. You know, like when I saw him that last night, there was just something in that look where I think, honest to God, you guys, he went into that game not thinking he would score 60. I don't think he thought, I'm going to take 50 shots. He didn't know what that game was going to bring him. He wanted to compete one more time. He wanted the Jazz to play hard. The Jazz did. The game got going. The players started feeding him. And then he saw that they were within striking distance. And I think he wanted to win that game. I think he wanted to win it so bad, because at the end of the day, that's what I think he was about. Like, he wanted to compete and he wanted to end on a high note. And I'm telling you guys, of all the athletic events I've been a part of, I cannot explain what happened that night. It was magical. All the stars were out. They were standing like it was a game 7 the entire time. Everything had to go perfectly, right? Like, Houston won their game, so the Jazz weren't in the playoffs. The Jazz would have been playing to go to the playoffs, so they automatically had a little bit of a letdown. As well as they played in that first half, like, you know, it wasn't do or die for them, right? So they played their butts off, but it was a meaningless game. The refs let him play in the fourth quarter. Julius Randle was setting screens like a fullback and no calls, right? And Kobe somehow, and this is what I'm getting to my point to answer your original question, he was exhausted. I mean, I talked to Byron Scott late that night, and he said he went to him at the 9-minute mark and the 6-minute mark and said to him, can I get 6 more from you? Can I get 9 more from you? And Kobe looked at him and he goes, I thought the guy was just going to like say no. He was that dead out. And he would go, yeah, I got you, B. And he'd get up. But the lift that he had on his last 5 shots, he hits his last 5 shots, the 3, the elbow jumpers, the lift. And all of a sudden he was like 24-year-old Kobe again. And I thought to myself, you mother effer, this guy, like James Worthy and I, we were dying. We're like, you got to be kidding me that this guy's going to go out like this. With the crowd going crazy, he got to 50, then he got to 60, and they win the game. And to me, it was like, you know what? This guy is, say what you will about him. Say he's selfish. Say he's maniacal. Say he's not a great teammate. Say whatever you want to do. Those young guys on that Laker team learned more in one night about how to play, how to give it your all, and how to be a winner than they learned in 2 years. There's no question about it. They watched him, and they were in awe. I talked to those guys after. They were completely baffled to see a guy in that moment do what he did. Special. So for me, like, he catapults even up even more. You know, he's not Jordan, but he's in that conversation of an all-time great. There's no question about it.
We're going to bring on Mark Sherman, the newest announcer on the AVP.
What's up, Mark?
What's up, Gator?
What's happening, buddy?
Not much. Just hoping I don't get kicked out of outdoor Starbucks when they close in 3 minutes. But I think I'll be good. Yeah, I'm at the good side. Hey dude. Yeah. So a couple questions. John told me, you were coming on the way back from New Orleans last night. So thought of a couple things. So yeah, first thing. So when there's so much chaos and craziness going on around you, whether you're in studio or at a live event or you know, at the Lakers game where I sure it was nuts. Like, so when there's that much craziness going and chaos around you, how do you stay focused on your job? Do you sort of take it all in? Do you try to ignore it? Or what do you do?
Well, I feel like you're probably asking this because I know where you've been. I mean, people don't realize that when you're doing those intros to the finals or you're calling a match, you know, you have 10 people telling you what to do, right? There's nothing crazier than an AVP event or an international event before you go on and there's live TV and it's NBC and you have 15 people telling you what to do and you got guys in your ear. It can be pretty frustrating, Mark. And I'll tell you, man, it took me a while to get to a place where, listen, there's a part of me that likes chaos when it's fun chaos. Like, I'm better when I have people around me and we're having fun. But in those moments where I'm going to go on and, you know, light's going to be on and they're saying go and you're like, hey, it's the ABP, you know, listen, those moments, I don't want people freaking out around me. Like, for me, I don't like the negative vibes. If they get me in a bad mood, then I know my performance is going to be bad. And this is just me personally. I need to be like a happy guy. I need to be in a good place and I need to be confident before I do any of that stuff that you've been doing as well. And for me, I just got to a point where I would separate myself. I would always say, oh, I got to go down and get ready. And I would go down to, like, dude, even like a porta potty or a player's tent, you know, and just get a moment away from everybody. Because once you get into that arena, everyone's on you, right? So I always needed a few moments to kind of gather my thoughts and hit my bullet points in my head. And I think when it gets in those most hectic moments, you know, I think you have to remain really calm inside, even if you're having fun with it and you're enjoying moments. And I'll give you a perfect example, Mark. My boss, and I don't know if he's ever going to listen to this, but one of my bosses, he was in my ear and he was kind of like lit me up in the pregame show about something. We had a great pregame show and I knew I was going to be doing a stand-up, just me and doing it on camera. It was going to be the biggest one of the night because it was going to be the Emmy reel that we put forward. And he had been pumping me up about it all week, like, dude, the Emmy reel, don't blow it. Make sure you write some cool stuff and, you know, you're ready. And he kind of heckling me. And I'm like, yeah, great. Well, we get to that commercial break and there's like a 6-minute break before I come on because they were showing a feature before that. And like, he hears me. He's back in the studio and I'm at site. He can see me and he can hear me. And a friend walks by and I'm like, hey, what's up, Beto? And I give him this. And all of a sudden he snaps. Get ready. And he like screams and I'm like, and I come to and I like look at the camera and I'm like starting to feel like a little sweating, like lighten me up a little bit. And he's like, I need you focused. And all of a sudden I hear in my ear from my other producer, Gator, you're on in 4 minutes. And I thought to myself, dude, I'm on in 4 minutes and you're lighting me up. And I was thinking to myself, dude, you're the worst coach. I mean, I feel pretty safe that he's not going to hear this. I was thinking to myself, you would be a horrible coach, dude. You completely, that was like opposite of what Phil Jackson would do. You went completely ballistic and yelled at me before the biggest segment for no reason. And I was like kind of pissed, Mark, for like, I got to be honest with you. I was just telling my wife this. I was pissed for like probably 30 seconds, 45 seconds, where I was a little rattled. And here I am, like, I've done this a million times, yet I was kind of like, and dude, thank God I had the time. But after about 30 seconds, I thought to myself, dude, who cares? Like, it's live TV. He's stressed. I don't know what's going on back in the studio. Everyone's freaked out. You can't hear him anymore. Like, get yourself together. Let's enjoy this moment. And I looked over and like Rob was worried, not even paying attention. He's laughing at something. I'm like, dude, look where you are, dude. Pinch yourself, dude. You're a lifetime Laker fan that's on the floor at Staples about to do a hit on Kobe Bryant. Are you kidding me? So it's funny, Mark. I then kind of like became calm and had like a little laugh of myself. Like, I feel like when I can laugh, I'm always really calm. I had a little laugh, a little moment, went into the camera and it went great. But I remember for those 30 seconds, I was pissed, dude. And I wanted to go to him. I almost started a little argument with him. Like, why would you do that? Because deep down, I still want to know why he did that. I feel like if I go into work tomorrow, I'm going to ask him. Because it's kind of pissing me off now that I think about it. But, you know, you're always going to have those guys, Mark, especially doing NBC leads or whatever. You know, you're going to have people in your ear. You're going to have panic moments, you know, especially out on the beach where so many things can go wrong with satellites and all that stuff. And you just got to be ready for it when it happens, embrace it, enjoy it. And at the end of the day, dude, you're entertaining, right? Like, be yourself and have fun with it. Everyone else is going to go off your vibe. And if you're digging it and you're going nuts and you're having a good time, dude, they're going to love it too. You know, I've also gone on air and, you know, had a poopy diaper face and done something. And at the end of the day, I think to myself, dude, the person at home doesn't know you're in a bad mood. Like,
right.
Who cares if you don't feel well or if you're upset with something? You're the one who comes across, you know, unprofessional. You're the one that comes across like you have a poopy diaper. Like no one else cares, dude. They have no idea at home that my boss just yelled at me. So I've had to learn through the years, and it's not easy, but I've had to learn that, you know, once the light's on, dude, you got to get to a good place and you worry about that stuff later. And you know what, Mark, I'll tell you, 9 times out of 10, by the time you get off the air, the time you're done with the thing, you don't even remember what happened anyways.
Thanks, Peter.
Bye, buddy.
It's always nice having a Northridge guy on the microphone.
It's not an easy job, right?
Oh, gosh. Especially when, like, Mayer's getting waxed and it's a boring final. Like, what do you do?
Too many Northridge guys.
Speaking of which, listener Andrew Fuller asks, what players would be on Northridge Volleyball's Mount Rushmore?
First of all, I love Andrew Fuller. Let's just get that out there. But, okay. Coley Kyman for sure. Matt Unger for sure. Bob Samuelson for sure. And, man, Billy, is there anybody over the last 15 to 20? I'm trying to think of some new guys that might.
I can't think of anybody good. Like, those, anybody. No one like that Chad, I can see.
Like Chad Strickland was an All-American, but he's not. He's not. Yeah. Nils. Besides Nils, maybe? Well, I mean,
Who?
No, honestly, what do you guys think? I mean, when you guys think of the greats, you think of probably Coley for sure.
Those three.
Yeah, you got to think of Sammy. Sammy was the best up to his time. And then Matt and Coley for sure. You know, like Lynch, Kaufman, Strickland. You know, there's some great players. You know, Axel Hagar was pretty damn good, won a bronze medal at the Olympics. But was he Mount Rushmore good? That's a tough one.
Listener Tom Black asks, what made Geeter one of the greatest PGs in Crespi Athletics history? Hashtag never picked in the backcourt.
Tom Black and I, this is a true story. We went to school together from grades 1 all the way through 12. He was 2 years behind me. I watched Tom blossom into like a unbelievable stud athlete / model. I don't know how it happened. It happened overnight. Too bad he went to UCSD. Could have been a great matador. But, you know, it's funny he says that. I got picked in a summer league game my senior year by a kid named Charlie Crow, who used to go to Crespi, who could never sniff my jock. He never could start. He transferred to El Camino. He actually picked me in a summer league game. And I said to myself, that ain't happening. And the entire regular season through the CIF playoffs, I never got picked as a point guard my senior. That is true, Tommy. You know it, buddy.
A different Kevin Lynch asks, what succeeds more, calmness under pressure, boring Mayer style, or like crazy fire like Patterson?
Well, listen, it's whatever works for that individual. Like if John Mayer started acting like Casey Patterson, some might say he's rattled or might not be his game. There might be moments where he might show a little extra passion. Todd Rogers played a lot like John Mayer. I mean, they're both very, very steady and they play their game and it's not their personality to be out there yelling and then screaming and doing backflips. They're at their best when they're really calm. Believe me, the fire is inside John Mayer and Todd Rogers. I mean, they're just as competitive as anybody who's out there screaming. Even more, I mean, John won the national championship and played every position besides middle at Pepperdine. The guy's as competitive as can be. He just shows it a different way. And when he's in pressure situations, he knows he's getting served. He delivers and he's steady. Casey Patterson is an entertainer type of guy that loves that moment. When Casey's not popping and locking and doing his thing, guess what? He's not winning. So when he's popping and locking, be scared if you're the opponent, because that's when he's never felt better. So it's whatever makes you you. Whenever you're you in that moment, that's the best guy you got to be under pressure. Don't try to be anybody else under pressure. If you want to act a different way, you're taking yourself out of your game. You're getting in your own head.
Great stuff. Well, Gee, thanks so much for all the time and all the knowledge and all the great stories. There's so much, not just funny stuff, but just good nuggets in there that I think people can really appreciate. And I think a bigger thank you for all you've done for our sport. You know, a lot of players have come and gone since I've played and they get forgotten pretty quickly, but yeah. You're a guy that never, like, people are always talking about.
And I appreciate them.
And just such a lasting impact on our game, and just appreciate all you've done. And we, everyone misses you and always look forward to seeing you. I think you'll be at Long Beach again.
Yeah, I'll be at Long Beach. I would love to get down to Huntington to watch you guys play a little bit, and I'll definitely be at a couple AVPs when I can. And, you know, not to get too sentimental, but I really appreciate you guys, you three especially. You know, I've always held in high regard. I got a nice little place in my heart for you three. You guys are great dudes. I love your wives. And I appreciate what you guys do for volleyball and stuff, man, as well. And for me, to be honest with you, Johnny, Nils, and Billy, dude, you know I love the sport. And like, if there's a way I can still be involved and still be around it, I will. I miss coaching. Hopefully my daughters, you know, one day want to play and, you know, I can coach them up. But I just always want to be in tune to the sport. I always want to help it. You know, for me, like I even said, I always thought I got a lot more credit than I deserve. I was just a little part of it and I loved it. And I always want to be a little part of it. And I'm not, I never want to be, and I'm never going to be Oscar Robinson, those older guys who say Steph Curry's like wouldn't have lasted in their day. Dude, the game is getting better. Everything's getting better about it. I'm watching that game on TV and it looks good. And you know, it's not about the glory days, man. The glory days are still ahead of us. So you guys keep doing it. You're passionate for the game. You guys are still out there playing the sport we love, man. That's, you know, that's why I'm out there playing fours all the time with my boys, dude. I love it.
Gator, you fire me up. I think I'm gonna go lift some weights right now.
All right, man.
All right, fellas. Later. Say hi to the wives.
Next week will be our 50th episode of Coach Your Brains Out. We'll discuss what we've learned over the past year of doing the podcast and some of the changes we've made as both players and coaches, plus some highlights from our first 49 episodes. We have a lot of exciting things planned moving forward, so thank you for listening and spreading the word. Please subscribe on iTunes to get all our episodes and follow us on Twitter and our Facebook page.